F off back to Russia.
Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first, let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member. But interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events. But when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, et cetera. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted, Black Lives Matter, and then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union, but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats, right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted, and in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 a.m. when people are expecting to be sleeping, right? So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, et cetera, we need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, you know, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, you know, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird. It's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah. So I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right, there's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained, right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them, right, in a disrespectful or harmful way. You know, I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but, you know, put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned. And then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. You know, so that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah. And also, I think a thing about professors is that most of them by far are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance, and the students have to know, or have to at least feel, that they're at risk of, if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups, does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world: racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression. And we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. The fence was posting messages that were very, very provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian Alliance students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive and what the Jewish students were hearing and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who is going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now, because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate, because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate, and some of the people who are coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event, from people who came and were on counter-protests to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe, and that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest. It has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register, versus your vote that's conservative the register, we don't care. All the only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So, as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Chinas about free speech. So, on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, you know, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chemerinsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved, and one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff, if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic, or, you know, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky you know, issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on. And so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing. You might think that I'm an okay person, and I'm okay. Well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make a judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, for, you know, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it, so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make, or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us, it's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grinnell, Ambassador Grinnell, coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right, which was also, I think, highly controversial. But we stood up and we protected her ability to say that, and Rick Grinnell's ability to say that, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear, and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cohen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in. Get it out there and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, we were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be, we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is, suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany, and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said, no, don't say anything. And the same thing, I think, about George Floyd. I mean, that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society, that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak, and then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. We'd rather spend, I think you'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think so. We have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around, and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour or within 2 hours every time. It's not practical. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities, right? Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right? You know, inevitably, in the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations and we consider, well, we need to respond to that. They're saying something we know to be false. Somebody else says, don't say anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things, troll people, and use statements that they would never say face-to-face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think that it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well, I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme. But I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were like interacting with their friends, sometimes they'd speak in person, sometimes they'd call them on the phone, sometimes they'd text them. And they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be. Right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how you're going to say something. But the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully, over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly, but if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap. Right. And I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if that's your main diet, you get addicted to it, it's just stressful, you feel anxious, you don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into context in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently, and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech, right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to a special edition of Ebony Spectrum. Let's get caught up with what's going on in Texas.
Tuesday, August 12th. And what's happening essentially is that the saga that we've been talking about on the show in Texas, wherein a number of Democrats left the state in order to try to forestall a racist gerrymandering that is specifically designed to reduce Black representation in Texas. This was halted by Democrats actually leaving the state, going to Illinois, going to Massachusetts, going to New York. And that has seemed to be very effective in stopping the governor from passing these racist maps. Apologies, I forgot to welcome you all to the Joy Reid Show. This is an unplanned breaking news live, so thank you all for being here. I see you all jumping into the chat. Thank you all for coming through. But I wanted to jump online to talk with our new good friend, State Representative Jolanda Jones, who was on with us yesterday with her maps explaining these racist redistricting plans. Well, now it appears there is some breaking news in this, what I have been calling the Texit, the Democrats leaving the state in order to stop Greg Abbott and the Republicans from doing what they want to do. Representative Jones is back with us, and she's got some updated news. Talk to me about what this end game apparently is starting to look like.
So we don't know what the end game is yet. So what we do know is the special session with these racist redistricting maps, as you call them, would naturally end on the 19th, August 19th, which is Tuesday. And every day the governor and the speaker have gotten up and made big brouhahas about how we stopping stuff from getting done and how dare we, and we running. Well, we ain't running from nothing, because at least I ain't never been scared. And we collectively are not afraid of the governor. So I think he is embarrassed. Otherwise, I mean, he's been beating his chest, you know, the whole time saying, y'all better do this, otherwise we're going to do this. And there's really no otherwise, right? He can't find us. We're not in Texas. The subpoenas in Texas don't do anything in Illinois or California or Massachusetts or New York. So he needs to just go on. And so he's ended it. He told us today, we're going to end it on Friday if we don't have a quorum. Well, newsflash, he's not going to get a quorum. And he says, and I'm going to call another one immediately. Okay, so he has to have to actually start over. So we're waiting to see what he does. So we're trying to figure out, like, what do we do now? Because our goal was to kill the first special session. And we have done that. And let me tell you, by us texting, because I like that. So imitation is the highest form of flattery. So I'm going to use that. I'm a texter, right? So see how that worked? You understand?
Yes, Harvard. I like it. I like it.
Right? And so we did this. So we're up 1-0. And I was just trying to figure out what our next move is. Let me tell you some wins that us texting did. One, it killed this special session, so those racist maps cannot be shoved down our throats. And let me remind you what those racist maps do. Those racist maps will literally whittle down four Black congresspeople to two if their plan goes into place. So that's a problem, because as you showed yesterday, most Black people live in Houston and Dallas. They're getting rid of two Black congresspeople in Houston and Dallas, and it's just going to be hard to recover from that. So we were able to stop that this special session. The second thing we were able to do was to get our Democratic governors in Democratic states. I'm choosing my words carefully, Joy. Let's see what words I want to use. To get them to drop You understand what that means? And they're basically like, try them in Texas, governor or president, and we're going to try you in California. So just like you can take black and brown seats in Texas, we can take out your white seats in California, in New York. They can't do it immediately because they have some constitutional issues, but they can do it. So California can do it before 2026. New York can do it before 2028. So basically, if you want to go on this wipe out black and brown people, you know, parade in Republican states, then we can wipe y'all out and then we can just go. So we were able to do that. The next thing we were able to do is I got to meet you. So we literally have the world media talking about what's going on in Texas. Because if things are done in the dark, then you don't know what's going on. People probably don't know why Trump has been able to pass these really bad bills that have affected us all negatively, i.e. so many of us being wiped off of Medicare and Medicaid, or our Social Security being cut after we paid into it forever and we deserve our damn retirement when we get older because we earned it. It's not a handout. We worked and we put in our sweat equity with our lives. And for example, US citizens being deported. Who would think that? Families being separated. And I'm gonna bring this up, although I'm not a farmer, but I do buy food that was raised on farms and grown on farms. My groceries are higher, vegetables are higher, because farmers can't maintain their farms because of all these damn tariffs that Trump has. So you wonder why backpacks that used to be $15 are now $50, the eggs that used to be $6 are now $13, or paper towels. My mother is obsessed with paper towels, okay? That's the only reason why I'm even paying attention to it. I bought six rolls of paper towels that cost $13. I'm like, what kind of world am I living in? And my mother used up all the damn paper towels in 2 days. You know, she lived in my house. I told my mama, you can't do that, mama. This costs $13 now, okay? So I punished her. I stopped putting paper towels in the house for a little while. But my point is this, that all these bad things are happening. And we're like, how did this happen? You want to know how it happened? Because North Carolina had three seats taken from them by the Republicans. And they did some racist gerrymandering. And they did the exact same thing. And so that is the three vote majority that Trump has. So what happened in North Carolina is affecting you in Tupelo, Mississippi, or Des Moines, Iowa, or Honolulu, Hawaii, or wherever. And we also about to be in all these damn wars. And it's all because they stole congressional districts in North Carolina. And so fool us once. So we got fooled in North Carolina. That's on somebody else. But if we get fooled twice in Texas, then that's on us. And that's why we were forced to quorum break / Texit, because we had to not allow the Republicans to get a quorum, which is 100 of the 150 members, because in the game in the Texas House, it's almost like being on a plantation. There's 88 Republicans, there's 62 Democrats, and the math don't math ever for 62 to beat 88. So the only play we had was to stop them from getting a quorum. And I don't call that cowardly. I don't call it running. I call it gangsta, and I call it brilliant, and I call it we playing chess and you playing tic-tac-toe. You ain't even playing checkers. So that's what we had to do. So now it ended before we thought it was going to end, because he kept beating his chest and trying to Debo everybody. Black people, y'all know what that means, the Debo, right? If all you got to do is look at Friday. And now we've got to figure out what's our next step, right? Are we going to let California and New York and them, you know, follow through with what they've said, which is Trump and Abbott, if you insist on doing what you're going to do in Texas, then we got you over here and we got you over there and we got you over here. Or we also need, for people watching this show, you need to vote. Like, no matter what, when you don't vote, they win. So Trump scares the crap out of people. And they vote because they're afraid of us, although there's nothing to be afraid of us for. So the question is, are we afraid of Trump? Because if you think that man and his cronies the billionaire guys, I should call them the billionaire boys because they act just like boys. Do you think that they are going to stop with what they're doing? No, they're trying to take us back to before the Voting Rights Act. That's what this is about. They're literally trying to take away black and brown people's right to vote. And while you may be apathetic and you think government doesn't work for me, I'm just not going to vote, at least you have a vote not to use. I wonder how you'll feel if they literally take away our votes.
So my question is, Representative, there seems to me, and I'm hearing from some news leaks that are out there in the world, that there are some Democrats who were part of this Texit who want to go back. And what I want to say, and I'm not going to put this on myself, I'm not going to put this on you, I think it would be absolutely insane to go back right now. There are people fundraising. You explained brilliantly yesterday that it is completely legal for people to donate. People can keep these Democrats where they are in Illinois, in New York, in Massachusetts, wherever they are. If you all are able to stay away and stop this governor and this legislature from passing these maps, that's a win. But I am hearing, and the reason I wanted to talk with you again, that there are some members of this Texit crew who are saying that they've already won and that the attention that they've received is enough, and that going back right now would be a victory, when we all know, based on what Wendy Davis did when she, and I would give her all the credit in the world, put on her pink sneakers and filibustered to try to stop a bill that even before Roe v. Wade would have taken away women's bodily autonomy. In the end, when her filibuster ended, they passed the bill.
Right.
And so the reality is, if the Democrats go back, and this is what I want you all to know, and this is why I wanted to jump on this live with the state representative right now this evening, even though this is on our off night, but I wanted to do it because my message to all the other Democrats, including your leadership, those who are leading this Texit, it would be insane to go back. It would not be a victory to go back. No one is going to cheer for you for going back. No one is going to hail Democrats for going back if the maps still pass. Can you reiterate again what it will mean if Democrats go back and enough Democrats go back that they can get a quorum? What's the next thing you expect the governor and the legislature to do?
So here's what I know the governor is going to do, just because I've seen him do it in the past. The Republicans have the votes, so they'll have kangaroo hearings like they did before. Overwhelmingly, people will come and say, don't do this redistricting, don't do these maps, they're racist, we don't want you to do it. Wait till the lawsuit that's going on right now that hasn't been resolved. I think briefs are due in September, right? Why don't you wait to see how, if the 2021 racist redistricting maps, if they stand or whatnot, and just wait. And just like they did this time, they basically were like, we don't care, we're going to push it through, which is why we had to get up out of there, right? And so, because they know they have the votes. You only need 76 votes to pass, and which means they don't even need all of the 88. Although I believe that they'll get 100% of the 88, because all the Republicans in Texas are terrified of Trump. I don't understand how they're individually elected by their respective constituencies, and they're afraid of Trump like he's a bully on the block. I mean, generally, their stuff is swinging, right? You know, I'm a state rep. I can do this. I can do that. But when Trump says stuff, they say, please, okay, what do you want? How much do you want me to jump? It is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. I've never seen white men, powerful white men, cower like I've seen them cower with Trump. So I fully expect that he's going to call the second special session. I fully expect that he's not going to put flood relief on first, as we've asked, because we did lose over 130 Texans, 37 of which were children, and there are still some lost kids, and that's still not more important than redistricting. And we've told him, do the floods first. And he won't do it, so I expect him to do the exact same thing. And if we make quorum, then the maps will pass. That is my prediction, because even Democrats are afraid to call the maps. Even choosing my words carefully. Not all of us are calling the maps what they are, which is racist. Because, you know, some people don't want to say the word because people tell them that they're pulling a race card. And as I said before, I'm going to pull that sucker. If I have to pull all 52 cards in a deck, plus two more jokers, and the big joker and the little joker, I will call them that because it is, and I will pull them because it is what it is. And then two black seats will be lost. We will be down to two. We will have no diversity. We will have no representation. We will have districts that we're not used to because they've literally moved things, as we showed yesterday. And we're going to hope and wish and pray that we have representation. And the case won't go to court for years. And so,
tell me when you all have heard. First of all, I think that the messaging, other than yourself and Jasmine Crockett Representative Al Green, the three of you seem to have messaging that makes sense. You and I talked yesterday. You are an attorney, and you talked about the fact that in the Supreme Court, first of all, it is the accurate argument that this is racist gerrymandering. We explained yesterday, we showed you all the maps. The maps are all posted at joannereed.com. You can go, you can pull that right off the Substack. You can look at them, zoom in on them. You can look at them for yourself. So we have the evidence that it is racist gerrymandering, but only the three of you are really calling it that, which doesn't help in the Supreme Court. If it goes to the Supreme Court, if you say it's political gerrymandering, they're going to
keep
their maps.
It hurts.
Correct. What's been the explanation from your leadership of the Texas Dems? I will note that there are some people who are, you know, black Democrats in Texas, but they may not be, as Representative Al Green called it, liberated Democrats. I love when Representative Green said he's a liberated Democrat. I decided to say that I, too, am a liberated Democrat. And I would say you, good sister, are a liberated Democrat. It's a different kind of Democrat. But not everyone is. Some people are a little more cautious. What has been their messaging, and what have they said they want your messaging to be?
We haven't decided the messaging. I mean, we won, right? We stopped special session. The governor thought he had all the power, and he found out over time that he doesn't have the power that he thought that he had. So he's got to figure it out. So we've got to figure out what happens next, whatever he does, whatever it is he does. We literally haven't figured out what our next move is because we can't anticipate what he's going to do. As a former athlete, I can't prepare a plan if I don't know what you're going to do, because I may not prepare the accurate plan. We've got to wait to see what their call is, and then we'll respond accordingly. And so that's just sort of the posturing that we are. We're just trying to figure out, when do we go back to Texas? Because the reason now let me be clear. He said that he's going to end the session on Friday. Today is Tuesday.
Okay.
So I know that I'm not going back to Texas before it's officially ended, because it doesn't end naturally until next Tuesday. So he could be lying. I mean, it is my belief that quite often when his lips are moving, he's lying. And so let me be clear. I'm from the hood. I got plenty of common sense. I got plenty of street sense. I'm not about to get got like that. I mean, I'm just not. So I'm going to make sure that the session is ended before I even consider going back. I'm hopeful that we'll go back, you know, whatever it is we will do together, because the only reason we've been able to be successful is because we have stuck together as a caucus. And I mean, but a caucus is just like family. You know, you don't always agree with your sister. You love your sister, but you don't always agree with her. And you hope you have more in common than you don't have. So we're going to have to work out all that stuff. But it was a surprise that he ended it. We're thankful. We're going to take this W. Right, not W, W. Mm-hmm. And then we will figure out what our next move is by what the governor does.
And not just what that governor does. And I'm putting this on you, on myself. I would not put it on you, Representative. I'm just going to put it on myself. if it was me and I was able to speak to the other Democrats, and there are 18 black Democrats, including two in the state Senate, 16 in the House. For those of you who are texting, whether you left the state or you are staying home and not going into work and you're not getting into the patrol cars that are trying to use almost slave catcher style, dragging people back into session so that they can force them to vote, whether you are Latino Democrats in Texas, who they're coming for you too, because they're going to also reduce your representation by pitting two Latino Democrats against each other and pulling voters out of a third Latino district. So they're getting y'all too. And so the reality is, it is clearly racial, clearly racist. It's all black and brown Democrats who would be losing their seats in a state where black and brown Democrats are already underrepresented. If you all go back, not just before this governor officially ends the session, but if you go back before Gavin Newsom puts out his maps where he says how many Republicans he's taking, before Kathy Hochul in New York puts out her maps to say how many Republicans she's taking, if you do it before the governor of Illinois, Governor Pritzker, puts out his plan for how many he's taking, and until we find out what other states are going to seize Republican seats and how many, until you know what that board looks like, there's no reason to knock all of your pieces off of the table. And so what I am saying, based on just some of the things that I'm hearing out there in the atmosphere, and again, I'm putting this just on myself. I wanted to do this live because I really am speaking to you, Representative, but I'm really speaking to your whole caucus. You all should not go back. You all were going to be out till the 19th, right? Wasn't the 19th the original?
That was target date? Because that's when it would have ended naturally. And so there are those of us who, you know, want to stay. And, you know, there are people who think, well, it ended early, so why, you know, why would we stay? And I mean, I can understand that, except that it's not over yet. I mean, we literally are still in a special session. He says he's going to do this on Friday, but we don't know he's going to do it on Friday, right? But the only way to be absolutely certain that it's over is on Tuesday, like for sure. So we actually have to wait to see if his word is his bond, at least in this case, to see if he actually ends it on Friday. And then we have to figure out if he calls it again. They literally can call a special session and give us 6 hours to report. So we could get back to Texas and he could say, we have a special session, be here within 6 hours. And then what? You know, so we just got to see. And it's like, it's almost like herding cats. You know, there's 62 of us, right? You got to call me. Am I going to answer the phone? You know, am I busy? Am I catching up with my family because I ain't been home since we left? Am I playing with my granddaughter and I got my phone on silent? Am, you know, and it gets, and then they know we're back in Texas. Well, they have the popo out looking for us. Like, make sure, like, are we going to be, like, secretly surveilled? So that if we try to jet to the airport, they stop us or whatever. So, I mean, there are, I think, all kind of dangers with going back. And so I'm just waiting to hear what the team play is, because as you and I have had conversation, I've been a very high-level athlete. I've been on the USA track and field team. I was an All-American in basketball and an All-American in track. Both instances, I ran on the relays, right? So that's a team sport. Basketball is obviously a team sport. I'm just waiting on a play call for the coach. And whatever that play call is, I'm going to do it, right? Because I can't be an individual when I'm a part of a team. It's just that simple. So we have not decided, because it's a breaking story. It is a developing story that just happened today. And so now we're trying to figure out, like, what our next move is.
Yeah, I at a very much lower level than you, I ran track as well, and I was third leg. And so I understood the assignment, which is that you are supposed to, you know, advance the team by jumping off those blocks when it's your turn, getting that baton and making sure you pass it in a winning position. It would not be a winning position. And I'm just saying this to you, Democrats. If you all go back, that W that the representative just talked about would turn it to an L. I don't know if I'm this way on the thing, because if they pass the maps, you lose. The moral victory of having left the state, it will be meaningless if they pass the maps. The point is to kill the maps. The only purpose is to kill the maps. The only real W is to kill the maps. If the maps don't die, then you didn't win.
They multiply.
They look, multiply.
I'm a poet and didn't know it.
If the maps don't die, they multiply. And so what I want to try to organize, all of those of you who are on, thank you to all the people. A lot of folks jumped on here. We appreciate you all. Those of you who are also on Substack, thank you all for being here. Those of you who are on the Joy Reid Show channel here on YouTube, thank you all for tuning in. And I know I hailed up my folks on Instagram to let them know this was happening. So if you popped over here from Instagram, we appreciate it. But we're doing strategery tonight, y'all. We are trying to help Democrats. Democrats sometimes have problems with messaging and strategery. They don't. It's not their strong suit all the time. And I can say that because I've been a Democrat since I was 18 years old. So we're trying to help us. We're trying to help them. Representative Jelana Jones is actually very good at communications and strategery. So we're trying to give free advice. We're giving out advice for free. And the advice that I'm giving to your colleagues, because I know you get it already, good sis, do not go back until the maps are dead. When the maps are dead, you can go back. Or when the retribution for the maps is in place. And the retribution will be in place when the governors of Democratic states that have Democratic-led legislatures have put out their plan and explained to Republicans what the punishment will be for taking away these two black seats. You may not think the most important thing in the world is for African Americans to be in Congress, but you better understand that the existence of these black members in Congress is why you have Obamacare. It is how you are going to be able to hold on to what's left of your Medicaid. It's the only way you're going to be able to potentially stop ICE from kidnapping people off the streets. If you don't love the invasion of Washington, D.C., that you saw today for no reason other than Donald Trump is terrified of the Epstein files and he needs to try to make black cities demonized and pretend that the crime is up when he said in May that crime in D.C. is way down. When Kash Patel accidentally said right next to Trump that crime is way down. And they're in D.C. taking it over and threatening to do the same in Baltimore and Chicago and all over any city that's got a black mayor because Donald Trump is terrified of the Epstein files. They don't want to release them. They know he's in them. And they're scared of what the results will be if his base finds out what he was doing with his good friend Jeffrey Epstein when they were friends for literally a decade or more. And so these distractions are bad, but what they could do if they continue to hold the House is much worse. It's much worse. I just saw in the Wall Street Journal today that they're going to fix, quote unquote, the Smithsonian, meaning the Blacksonian and all the other Smithsonian museums, so they're appropriate to Donald Trump's executive orders, meaning no truth in the museums because he thinks the 250th birthday of America is his birthday. These crazy things can be stopped, you guys. It can be stopped. But only by a House of Representatives in different hands. It cannot be stopped by the current House. It will not be stopped by the current House. And Texas right now is where the battle has been drawn. Texas is where the battle has been drawn. You have to play the cards that you've got. The cards we've got are these Texas Democrats staying the hell out of their state. So we came on here tonight, and I'm putting it on myself to tell the other Democrats besides Jelana Jones, who understands the assignment, that your assignment when this baton is handed to you in this relay race is to run in the opposite damn direction of Texas. Do not go back to Texas. And you all, if you are Texas voters, you ought to take names of any Democrat who goes back and lets them get a quorum. You ought to take names. This is me saying this. I'm not putting this on the representative. This is me. If you are a Texas Democrat, the power you have is called the primary. Even if Democrats do not control Texas, you control which Democrats get jobs. If they go back, they go away from their jobs. If they go back, don't vote for them again. Don't vote for them again. So we're just going to let you all know. All of you Democrats who have texted, stay out of the state or be prepared to explain that to the people who voted you in. Any other comments from you, Representative, that you now can speak for yourself? Because I've said a lot of things that I do not want to force to be associated with you.
let me be clear. I appreciate intellectual debate, especially with black women, because people seem to think we don't have a brain when we got plenty of brains. Okay, let me be clear. I think the only criminal crimes going on in D.C. are in the White House.
Amen.
So actually, crime is up in the White House. So he wasn't lying, but he's a criminal. is the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is we have been able to be successful. I mean, people have been saying that they were going to make quorum the entire time we've been here, right? Let's face it. And every time the quorum wasn't made, people were like, thank you, Jesus, right? Because we have been as strong as our weakest Democrat, quite frankly. And so when you're a part of a team, especially when you're at a high-level team, you got to figure out what the coaches are saying, and you have to buy into the philosophy. So right now I'm just waiting to hear what we're going to do. And then I'm going to run the play with the team. I was absolutely prepared, and am absolutely prepared to be gone, shit, for at least as long as Montgomery bus boycott, right, which lasted over a year, because for sure we'd be past the 2026 elections. Well, almost past, but you couldn't change the lines then. So we're going to see. I mean, I think we've played a good first round or a good first quarter, if you want to call it that. So let's see what they do in the second quarter, and then we'll respond accordingly, I'm hopeful. I mean, because the only, again, the